From NPR and WBUR Boston, I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and this is On Point.
Behind you, behind you, behind you, come on, get. Watch out, watch out.
Federal law enforcement officers again fired flashbang grenades and tear gas at protesters in Portland, Oregon last night. Portland Mayor Ted Wheeler was among the demonstrators. He was right up at the metal barricade separating the crowd from the Hatfield Federal Courthouse. Wearing plastic goggles and a paper mask, the Portland mayor coughed and choked as tear gas enveloped protesters.
This is an egregious overreaction on the part of the federal officers. There was nothing that I saw anybody do that warranted this reaction.
Wheeler called it, quote, urban warfare brought onto the people of this country by the President of the United States. Well, earlier this week, the president celebrated the actions of federal law enforcement in Portland and said he planned to send more officers to other U.S. cities.
We didn't just go there. This wasn't like it started right away. We went there after 51 days. We said, we can't let that happen anymore. But these are anarchists. And the politicians out there, yes, they're weak, but they're afraid of these people. They're actually afraid of these people. And that's why they say, we don't want the federal government helping.
Well, this hour on Point, is it urban warfare or is it a protective force? Is this an authoritarian tipping point? Well, we're going to start in Portland, Oregon, with Ryan Haas. He's news editor for Oregon Public Broadcasting. He's been covering the protest. Ryan, welcome to On Point.
Hi, thanks for having me.
First of all, can you tell us more about what happened last night when Mayor Wheeler joined the protesters there in Portland?
Yeah, so it was this really unusual scene last night. Portland's mayor, after 50-some days of protests, said he wanted to go out there and talk to protesters directly, and he wanted to see what was happening with federal officers and their reaction to protesters around the courthouse downtown. He went down and talked to demonstrators for quite a while, both on a loudspeaker and then just answering questions directly as people came up to him. And then he proceeded to stand at the fence around the federal courthouse. And shortly after, he was tear gassed multiple times before eventually leaving the scene.
Well, and that tear gassing has been happening night after night there in Portland since federal officers came into the city. But let me ask you just one point of clarification, Ryan. There was many of the protesters are also extremely critical of Mayor Wheeler, right? For a couple of reasons, as far as I understand. One is that this was the first night that he had been out there. And two, as mayor of the city of Portland, he's also the commissioner of police. Is that right?
That's correct. You know, folks were not happy with the mayor before this. And part of the reason for that is that the Portland Police Bureau themselves have used tear gas many, many times on demonstrators over the past 4 years, even. You know, we've often had demonstrations in Portland over various issues. And when the Portland police want to control those demonstrations, they often turn to tear gas or other less than lethal munitions to disperse crowds. So, you know, for protesters and demonstrators to see the mayor come out and say federal officers shouldn't be doing this, for them it sounds a little hollow when the Portland police have done the same to them many times. And even last night, after the mayor left, Portland police came out and declared the scene a riot and sort of threatened to use tear gas, although they never ultimately did.
Wow. Okay. So you know, Ryan, as you know, being a local reporter, at the national level, things that happen in U.S. Cities tend to get distilled into extremes. So on the one hand, depending on what your social media is, you might only be seeing images of federal officers firing tear gas. On the other hand, depending on what your social media is, you might only be seeing images of protesters in black throwing water bottles, right, at the Hatfield courthouse. Can you tell us just really, first of all, how much of these protests are, quote unquote, gripping the city of Portland? Has life been disrupted there or not?
Yeah, I think that's a very good point. No, I would not say life has been disrupted. You know, the president, or I believe it's the president or the head of DHS, described us as a city under siege. It is certainly not. You know, folks are still going about their normal daily lives. We're really talking about two or three blocks downtown around the federal courthouse that have seen kind of unrest over the night. And, you know, during the day, they're very normal city blocks like you would see anywhere else. So we're talking about a pretty contained area. And yeah, I agree with you. It really does depend on a person's personal views. You know, if you see demonstrators throwing water bottles at police as lawlessness, then, you know, I've seen folks say, well, this is warranted. Federal officers should be doing this. And I think the view here among many Portlanders is this is a disproportionate response to, you know, some folks who are angry at policing in this city.
So also just I appreciate your view, like from the heart of this story, because you heard the president a little earlier saying that he sent federal officers there after 51 days of protest. Now, the implication is that the protests were getting out of hand or around the courthouse so that DHS had to send its people there. But that's not what I understand, Ryan. Were things actually sort of winding down at that time?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, federal officers really kind of appeared on the scene here in early July, around July 1st, and then their presence kind of ramped up around July 4th. Around that time, you know, demonstrations over police brutality had been going on for those 50 days, but, you know, crowds were in maybe 100 people some nights, so they were relatively small at that point and were kind of diminishing. And the presence of federal troops has just really amped these protests back up. You know, you have entirely new groups of people who are coming out who are maybe not paying attention to those demonstrations before, who feel like, wow, this federal overreach, I need to go protest. So now we're seeing crowds again in the thousands coming out to demonstrate each night.
Now, Wheeler and, in fact, several other mayors of American cities have said they don't want, I mean, other mayors have said they don't want similar federal forces being sent to their cities. Do we have any idea, Ryan, what could happen next in Portland? Has there been any movement on a withdrawal of these DHS officers?
Not that I've seen. I mean, the Portland City Council yesterday voted and issued a resolution saying that Portland police should not communicate with federal officers in any way around these protests. So they're trying to really put up that barrier. But in terms of federal officers pulling out, I have not seen that at all. I've seen only language of doubling down coming out of the federal government and saying they're going to stay here. Yesterday, they proceeded to build a heavily reinforced fence around the federal courthouse, which, you know, kind of gives the impression that they're fortifying their position and not willing to leave, despite not being requested or desired by state or local or federal leaders from Oregon.
Well, Ryan Haas is news editor for Oregon Public Broadcasting. He joins us today from Portland. Ryan, thank you very much.
Thank you.
All right. Well, let's take a step back here and try to understand what the presence of Department of Homeland Security officers in Portland, Oregon, and soon perhaps in other American cities actually means about how the President of the United States views cities across this country. So joining us now is Tim Snyder. He is a professor of history at Yale University and also a permanent fellow at the Institute for Human Sciences in Vienna, Austria. He's author of many books, including On Tyranny, 20 Lessons from the 20th Century. Professor Snyder, welcome.
Very glad to be here.
So in your study of tyranny in the 20th century, how much of what you're seeing in Portland, Oregon, echoes with what we have seen before in the rise of authoritarian governments?
There are a number of, I think, quite profound resemblances. And I think it's important that we as Americans do step back, as you say, and think about patterns that we can see. One pattern, which is very evident in the president's language, is this business of us and them. That the protesters are anarchists, that this is some kind of left-wing insurrection, and therefore it's justified. that's a conspiracy theory. It's a, and it's not really a legal basis for action. And that's what authoritarian leaders try to do. They try to find something which sounds very frightening, like anarchism or terrorism. And that allows them to skip the step of saying, well, what exactly is the legal basis for sending police officers or federal officers and arresting people? Another thing which is very characteristic is that we don't know who these people are. In a normal rule of law state, in a normal democracy, you know who the police are and who they aren't. People don't turn up in vans with badly matched camouflage uniforms and just pull you off the street. That's not characteristic of a rule of law state, which is what we're supposed to be. It is characteristic, however, of an authoritarian regime. In fact, it's the typical nightmare in life and literature in an authoritarian regime, that people you don't know do things to you for reasons that you don't understand. And I guess a third thing,
I'm so sorry. Sorry, Tim, I'm sorry to interrupt you. There's a little bit of a delay, so if it sounds like I'm interrupting you, it's not intentional, but I just want to say that in other countries, they're called the secret police.
Yeah. I mean, if you look at this institutionally, what you find also is a very characteristic pattern where a new institution is being formed, these task forces, right, these special deployment groups, and Congress didn't pass a law. There's no real clear basis for it. And these people are operating under various kinds of cover. They don't have names. They don't have proper insignia. They're not identifying themselves. And so you're right. If we let this happen, then the next step, of course, is a bigger secret police, a more widespread secret police.
If we let this happen, we being if Americans let this happen, but we have about 30 seconds. We have to before the first break, Tim. You know, the president says he's protecting federal property and that he has a duty to do so. Is that not true?
Well, when I think of Homeland Security, I think of human beings and not objects. And when I think of the president's responsibilities, I think of them as protecting the Constitution rather than things in the world. I would say, on the contrary, what's happening is that we have a federal policy to deliberately make things worse, to create a spectacle of riot and a spectacle of violence, which then becomes politically useful. So, no, I don't think the president's analysis can be taken seriously.
Well, we are taking a close look this hour at what's happening in Portland, Oregon, what could be happening soon in other American cities as the president says he wants to send DHS officers elsewhere. We'll be right back. This is On Point.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/on point. That's Indeed.com/on point. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We're talking this hour about Portland, Oregon, about the President of the United States, and about the possibility of an authoritarian tipping point. Historian Tim Snyder is with us. Now, you've probably seen media images or social media images of those yellow-clad mothers protesting in Portland, the Wall of Moms. Well, Bev Barnum, she's a mother of two teenagers, she founded the group just last week, and she told us, she founded the group in order to help protect, to serve as a shield for protesters. And Barnum told us what her first night ever protesting, Saturday night, was like.
Us moms, we were holding the line. Like, I don't know how the fence came down, but as soon as it came down, the feds were, I mean, smoke everywhere, beanbag rounds everywhere. Yeah, it's like a war zone. When they come out, like, you're not human.
And Barnum told us that she questions the administration's justification for sending federal troops to Portland to begin with.
They say that they're protecting federal property. But here's the thing. From my vantage point, kids chanting and skateboarding and doing fireworks in the park and having a drum line, how does that define defending federal property? This is a democracy. Talk to us. Don't shoot us.
It's Bev Barnum, founder of the Wall of Moms in Portland, Oregon. Tim Snyder, we had begun to talk about this, about how the justification for the presence of these federal officers in Portland has to do with property. I mean, you look back even further and say that this links to the president's decree to protect statues in the United States. Why is that significant?
Well, it's very significant because it flips around the normal relationship between the government and the people. If our government is meant to be of the people, by the people, for the people, as Jefferson put it, then that means that people should be considered first. If all of a sudden statues or monuments or buildings are more important, then the federal government treats us as if we were the objects, and it treats the things as though they were what enjoys rights. And that sounds very strange, but that's actually what's going on. When we hear you're not treated as human, this is what follows from this. If people who are not wearing insignia and are wearing masks and can't really see you are treating you as objects that might damage something that's important, then you don't have rights anymore. So it's extremely significant that this is being flipped around, especially in a situation where the very origin of the protest, it has to do with the rights of African Americans. And of course, the story of African Americans in our country begins with them being treated as property. So there's a very deep historical significance to this, whether all humans are treated as humans or whether we start thinking about other things as being more important than humans.
So you really do see this as evidence of a flipping, as you're saying, about the purpose of how, whom and how the federal government is meant to protect.
Well, I think there are two things at work here. One, you have the patent failure in the last 3 or 4 months of the federal government to truly protect the security of the homeland, because this protecting the security of the homeland would mean something like making sure that people, regardless of race, are not subjects of arbitrary violence. And it would also mean that American citizens should not be dying by the tens of thousands of a virus. Those things shouldn't happen. If we truly had a secure homeland, those things wouldn't have happened. But since they did happen, the president now needs a rhetorical story of some other threat, a threat of anarchists, as he says, a threat of left-wing insurrection against buildings. The second thing which is happening is that there's an attempt to reframe what the Constitution is really about, that it's not primarily about human beings, but it's primarily about the myth of the country. I think this is really important, that rather than considering Americans as they exist in the world with their rights, with their needs, with their problems, Mr. Trump is trying to claim that government should be considering a kind of myth, and the myth is about the statues, it's about the monuments, it's about the buildings, and violence and force and extraordinary actions are necessary to defend the myth, even though they're not necessary to defend the people. It's really striking. I mean, what if all these people, what if all these guys in uniforms who are hitting people with batons had been handing out masks 2 or 3 months ago? We'd be in a very different country.
Mm. You know, I can hear that you took a pause at when you heard Bev say that when she felt that when the federal officers were coming out and pushing back protesters and tear gassing them, when she said, you're not human in their eyes. Now, you know, she's white and admittedly was living sort of a very happy life, an innocent happy life before the past 10 days. And, you know, and she told us that she's undergone a real awakening. And one could very understandably argue that her awakening is simply to the reality that, you know, as we know, that people of color have been living in this country for some time, being on the receiving end of excessive force from law enforcement. But that awakening makes me think that it no longer feels too far a stretch to think of that chilling and great quotation about you know, that came out of that we think about regarding the mid-20th century. In this world, you know, the first they came for the socialists and I did not speak out, right? Then they came for the trade unionists, et cetera, et cetera. And then they came for me and there was no one left to speak for me. Is it too far a stretch right now, Tim Snyder, to say that that is that path comes to mind?
No, it's, I mean, on the one hand, of course, it's not too far. It's not too far a stretch to say that. But once you say that, it suggests what the proper course of action is. And Bev, who you just had speaking, demonstrates the proper course of action, which is true for protests and it's true in general. The people who are most involved, most motivated, who most clearly understand the harm are the ones who are first on the street. And then very often it's the people who want to protect them who come next. That's a positive dynamic of protest. And then those two groups often come to understand each other better, which seems like it's been happening in Portland. So of course it's right to say that. If you let the people who are most at risk protest on their own, they will eventually lose. And because they've lost while you've just looked on, you won't be able to identify. If you get involved, then not only do you understand them better, but you have a stake in things in general being better, which is very important in the history of this country. Because of course, although it's African Americans who are directly in the line of their bodies, their minds, their lives, who are directly in the line of American racism, racism harms us all, not just because we're committing it, but because a climate of racism permits actions like this by a government and prevents actions like a solid welfare state or a good health care for everyone or fair voting for everyone. So something profound is at work here. And you're absolutely right that one has to think about these connections, not just negatively, but then, as Bev was saying, also positively.
Well, I want to play a little bit of tape here about the concerns that even former secretaries of the Department of Homeland Security have. For example, here's Jay Johnson. He was, of course, DHS secretary under President Obama. He was on MSNBC on Rachel Maddow's show on Tuesday. And he said that federal officers in Portland, he believes, is truly concerning for a number of reasons.
Problem number one, I do not understand how a federal law enforcement officer can arrest someone, put them in a government vehicle, take them away without probable cause. I do not understand that. Problem number two, if the mayor and the governor and the entire congressional delegation of a state are saying, don't come here, I'd have to stop and ask exactly what I am doing. Problem number three, and you made reference to this, would deploying such a force, heavily armed, in camouflaged gear, like what you see right now on the screen, if you deploy them, is it going to inflame tensions? Is it going to be unduly provocative and make the situation worse, not better? And problem number four, and I used to talk to DHS component leadership all the time, let's not engage in controversial one-offs that will have the ability to undermine and compromise our core missions.
That's former DHS Secretary Jay Johnson earlier this week on MSNBC. Timothy Snyder, there's something within what he said that I want to dig into with you. I've been saying DHS writ large, but what's really happening there in Portland is interesting. These are federal officers who some of whom come from the Customs and Border Protection, right? And they come from ICE, and they've been seconded into the Federal Protective Service so that they can do this work at the Hatfield Federal Courthouse. So these aren't officers that would usually be on American streets. Their jobs are to look for or to enforce immigration law at the border, and yet they're here and they're there in Portland. What is the what's the significance of that?
That's very significant, I think, in at least three ways. The most obvious of them you've already suggested is that these are people who are far from home. And they're outside of their normal command structure. And when you're far from home, then you generally behave more aggressively. And when the command structure is new and you're being told that you have a great deal of flexibility, you're also more likely to take more liberties, as these men are clearly doing. But there are a couple of other things which are interesting here historically. The first is that in the history of other groups of men who carry out crimes, it's often the case that they get their experience in a lawless zone first. So, for example, the German SS, the Nazi SS, they were first the guards of concentration camps, which, like our detention centers, are places where the law is thought not to apply. Once they have that experience, they can then be loosed on the general population. So I'd be curious to know how many of these men have been serving in our detention centers, because that's the kind of experience which would tend to create people who would behave the way these folks are behaving. The second thing which is interesting is the border itself. In the history of authoritarianism, it's also very often the case that men who were sent out to the border, who were treating people who are thought to be not us, who are thought to be aliens, who don't deserve full rights, that people who are trained in that way during an authoritarian tipping point, as you're calling it, are then brought back into the center of the country and told, well, these people are also not real Americans. They're not full Americans. We need to treat them the same way we're treating those people at the border.
So we have an unusual circumstance, like you're saying, with the where some of these officers have had much of their experience, and on top of that, so those are the people on the ground in Portland, and then above them in the structure of the very agency that they work for, the current person who's the head of DHS is an acting secretary. I mean, Chad Wolf has been an acting secretary for several hundred days now. He has not been officially confirmed by the United States Senate. He hasn't gone through that process because he's in the acting position. Does that remove one of the normative levers of accountability that American democracy would usually have?
I think it does in two different ways. The first is that since he hasn't been confirmed by the Senate, he's in no way accountable directly to the American people. He hasn't been reviewed, but also no one voted for anybody who confirmed him. That simply hasn't happened. But there may be a larger point here, which is that the way authoritarianism happens is not directly by breaking the law. It's very often by exploiting loopholes in the law. So our president has come to understand that if he just has acting directors and acting assistant directors, then they can serve simply at his pleasure and do what he wants. This is not, unfortunately, illegal, but it's stretching the law to the point where it's turning the law against itself, and things which are clearly against the spirit of the law are happening. That is very typical of an authoritarian transition. That's how it works.
Okay, so tell me more about that, because I feel like this is one of the factors underlying our not just our entire discussion, but what we have been seeing here, that authoritarian leaders look for loopholes and stretch the law. Can you just tell me more?
Yeah, I mean, this is a really important point, I think, for Americans, or at least many Americans, white Americans, who are used to thinking of the rule of law as being normal and, you know, God-given, coming from nature, just the way things are. And then when you think that, you imagine that a dictatorship comes about because suddenly evil people arrive on the scene and carry out a revolution or carry out lots of violence. And that's not the way it usually happens. The way it usually happens is that your constitution has some problems, or your legal system has some problems, and intelligent people, given a lot of time, can find those problems and govern their way through them. The critical concept here is the idea of an exception, that you claim, the president claims, a leader claims, that we're in an unusual situation, and therefore it's normal for us to use these loopholes. It's normal for us to cobble together different kinds of units from different parts of the federal government. It's okay to do all these things because there's an anarchist insurrection or whatever it might be. These are the classic two things that go together to turn a republic, which is what we should have, into an authoritarian regime. You have the legal loopholes and the things that are stretched, and then you have the attitude and the declaration, which the president has been declaring over and over, that this is an extraordinary moment where it's an extraordinary time where it's okay not just to stretch the point, it's okay to forget about the law, which of course is what's happening. I mean, the point should be made, I think, again, what's happening in Portland. These officers are kidnapping people. They're clearly breaking the law. That's the essential issue.
Well, we're when kidnapping people, when they're removing them from the street, putting them in unmarked minivans and spiriting them away. We're actually going to talk about that in great detail in a couple of minutes on the a little later in the show. But before that, Professor Snyder, you know, I have been saying authoritarian tipping point, but it seems to me that that's the wrong framing, because what you're saying is that it's more of a sort of slow bleed. And you don't just wake up one morning and you're surrounded by an authoritarian government. So how far would you say, based on your analysis of authoritarian governments of the 20th century, how far along that process of a slow bleed is the United States now? What other points of history or nations might we compare it to?
Yeah, that's a wonderful way of putting the question, because it's the authoritarian regime changes really aren't theatrical. They don't happen the way they happen in the movies. They happen when you're not looking, or they happen when you've decided to look another way, or they happen when someone has directed your glance another way. They happen because a leader tells you that someone else is a threat. They happen because a leader tells you that this moment is an exceptional moment where he has to just take power just for a moment, and then it turns out that it's permanent. And a lot, and probably most of authoritarian regime changes have to do with self-deception. When you tell yourself, I live in a special country, I live in a place where the institutions are going to protect me. That of course, is what a lot of Americans have done since 2016. And that's maybe the fundamental problem is American mm-hmm. exceptionalism. To answer your question, I mean, I think the first point...
Well, actually, Timothy Snyder, so sorry to interrupt. And the delay is what makes it sound like I'm interrupting you. But hang on for just a second, because we've got to take a quick break. And I'll get your answer to that fundamental question a little later in the show. So we are talking with historian Tim Snyder about Portland, about the president, and about the slide into authoritarian government. We'll be right back. This is On Point.
A gruesome scandal at the nation's most prestigious university shines a light on a macabre and lucrative world of buying and selling human remains.
Human body parts taken by a manager at the Harvard Medical School morgue and then sold to customers online.
So my first skull is right there on the top shelf. That's my first and my favorite.
I'm reporter Allie Jarmani, and this story raises some tough questions. How should we treat the dead? And who gets to decide?
There should be some middle ground where we treat deceased tissues differently than we treat old refrigerators.
This is Postmortem, The Stolen Bodies of Harvard, a new season of WBUR's Last Scene. Listen and follow Last Scene wherever you get your podcasts.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We are talking this hour about Portland, about the president, and what I had been calling an authoritarian tipping point, but I'm going to say more now, the slow bleed into authoritarian government. Now, it's not just the tear gas and the batons that federal officers are using when they come out of the Hatfield courthouse to push back protesters. As we've been mentioning a couple of times, unidentified federal officers have also been arresting people, sometimes away from federal property, by pulling them into unmarked minivans and then speeding away. Now, you might have seen the videos either on TV or on social media. Well, the Department of Homeland Security claims that this is a lawful act. Well, Harvard Law professor Andrew Crespo says no. He says it is, quote, a textbook violation of the Constitution. So listen with us for a couple of minutes as Crespo explains why.
What is going on?
We need to know
who are you?
Why are you taking
NLG will get you out. What's your name?
Tell us your name.
Okay, you're fine. We'll get you out.
Bro,
we got you, friend.
We got you.
Many people have seen the video of this van encounter in which two camouflaged federal agents approach a man on the street and put him in an unmarked van and drive away.
You just violated their rights.
Kidnapping people.
You just violated their rights.
At the press conference this week, a reporter asked Acting Secretary of Department of Homeland Security, Chad Wolf.
The question that I think many people have is, what exactly is going into those investigations? What level of probable cause are you getting? Because some people are saying...
Secretary Wolf turned it over to Chris Klein, Deputy Director of the Federal Protective Service.
The 40 U.S.C. 1315 authority does allow us to do investigations both on and off the property based on a crime occurring or an alleged crime occurring on federal property.
The Federal Protective Service, until a few weeks ago, was a little-known entity that many Americans probably hadn't heard of. But it's now at the eye of the storm. When Director Klein takes the microphone, he says to the reporter, You're probably talking about the van.
They asked the individual, please get in the van, and they did take them to an area that was safe for both the officers and the individual to do the questioning.
The agents, Klein says, were interested in the man in the video because earlier, they'd seen him in, quote, a crowd and in an area, end quote, where someone else was aiming a laser at the eyes of officers.
So it's not a custodial arrest. We need to question this individual to find out what their role was in this laser pointing.
I don't know if shining a laser at someone is a federal crime. It doesn't matter. We've all heard the saying that people shouldn't be treated as guilty by association. Well, that's also the law, as the Supreme Court said in a case called Ibarra v. Illinois back in 1979. Using a phrase that will stick in your mind, the court said, a person's mere propinquity to others independently suspected of criminal activity does not, without more, give rise to probable cause. In other words, standing near someone who the police think committed a crime doesn't mean that they have probable cause to arrest you. Klein goes on to say that the agents followed the man in the video, who again, they had no basis to arrest, to a calmer location away from the courthouse because they wanted to question him. So far as the Fourth Amendment goes, if that's all they'd actually done, there wouldn't be an issue. The police are allowed to walk up to you and question you in a consensual encounter, so long as a reasonable person in your shoes would think it's okay for you to walk away. These agents might have planned to execute one of those quote-unquote consensual encounters, or maybe not. But in any event, it doesn't really matter, because Klein admits, and the video is clear, that they did something very different. They forcibly removed the man from the scene. And again, not because of anything he did. According to Klein,
but as they approached him, they noticed that coming in their direction were violent demonstrators that now see what's going on and they want to go help. So they asked the individual, please get in the van, and they did take them to an area that was safe for both the officers and the individual to do the questioning.
Klein doesn't say explicitly where they took the man, but we know from other reporting that another person taken off the street in similar fashion, a man named Mark Pettibone, was taken inside the federal courthouse. And Klein does explicitly say that the man he's describing, the man from the van video, was questioned for approximately 20 minutes, something that these officers were unlikely to have done out on the street, given that they were apparently afraid of the surrounding crowds. And then, after those roughly 20 minutes, the agents, quote-unquote, released the individual. Why? Klein explains.
The individual was with the CBP officers for less than 20 minutes while they did the questioning. They had to get out of the area so they weren't attacked. And then they conducted the questioning and they released the individual because they did not have what they needed. The U.S. Attorney's Office is consulted on every engagement that our officers are doing. The U.S. Attorney's Office...
They released the individual because they did not have what they needed. At some point, government lawyers from the Department of Justice show up and apparently say to the agents, you got to let this guy go. You have no lawful basis to detain him. Translation. They didn't have probable cause when the lawyer showed up. They didn't have probable cause when they put the man in the van. They never had it. And they aren't saying they did. This isn't one of those law school exam types of cases where you're supposed to say, well, maybe he was arrested. This is one of those bar exam types of cases where they ask you, was this an arrest? A, yes. B, no. The answer is yes. The Supreme Court made this clear in a case called Dunaway v. New York back in 1979. In that case, it considered whether the police violated the Fourth Amendment when, without probable cause, they took someone, quote, into custody, transported him to the police station, and detained him there for interrogation. That is an arrest, period. So, the most troubling part of Director Klein's statement is actually not when he acknowledges the lack of probable cause. It's when he says that he thinks this was all legal and perfectly constitutional because, to use his words, it was, quote, a simple engagement.
It's not a custodial arrest. We need to question this individual to find out what their role was in this laser pointing. And unfortunately, got kind of spun out of control with the rhetoric about what happened. It was a simple engagement. The individual was with the CBP officers for less than 20 minutes.
That statement is glaringly wrong. It's been glaringly wrong since at least 1979. Let that sink in. The person in charge of this newly beefed up paramilitary federal police force doesn't know what an arrest is. It means he doesn't know when they're violating the Fourth Amendment. like they unquestionably did here. And if the deputy director of this new federal force will say on national television that what these officers did was legal because, quote, this wasn't an arrest, that raises serious concerns about what his officers are doing out on the street when the cameras are on and when they're not.
That's Andrew Crespo. He's a professor of law at Harvard University. Historian Tim Snyder is with us. He's author of On Tyranny, 20 Lessons from the 20th Century. And Professor Snyder, what do you think about Professor Crespo's assertion there that here there's we have an example here of the director Klein at DHS, according to Crespo, doesn't even know what the law is surrounding what a lawful arrest is?
Well, I would defer to Professor Crespo's judgment, but the case seems to be a very straightforward one. If you're taken away by force and questioned, you've been arrested. It seems that it's very troubling that to say that the man was not arrested is simply lying. I mean, this is what authoritarian propaganda sounds like. A man has been arrested and you find some other way to describe it, for example, as a simple engagement, which is false, but it sounds like a technical term, so you stop and think about it. That's how authoritarian propaganda works. And the second, in the overall atmosphere, is this idea that because we did it, it was legal. Because the government did it, it must somehow be legal. And that's exactly the spirit that the Constitution was written against. In the United States, it's supposed to be the case that the government can't act against citizens unless it has a legal basis, for example, probable cause. And in these statements that we've just heard, it's the opposite. It's as though just because we did it, all we have to do, since we did it, we just have to think of some simple way to describe it, and then everything's okay.
So this brings us back to the question that you were about to answer before we had to take a break a couple of minutes ago, because I had asked you, give us an example of other authoritarian governments and their evolution that we know of from the 20th century, and compare that to where we are in the United States on that slide towards that. Do you have an example?
Well, the example that everyone knows is that of Nazi Germany. So I'll stay with that. Nazi Germany happens because a flawed republic is put into a state of exception after a surprising event, which was a fire in the parliament. Nazi Germany had paramilitaries, which were organized by the government with very unclear lines of command drawn from all over the country. Nazi Germany had concentration camps where people were trained in a zone where there was no law, and then those people were set out later. That's the kind of classic trajectory, and we can see the common points. But it's also very important, I think, not to talk about just a slide or a tipping point, because this is not a process in the natural world that's inevitable. People react to it, and the people you've been talking to are reacting to it, whether it's a journalist or whether it's a lawyer or whether it's a protester. These are the people who are showing the kinds of things that can be done to actually halt the process, or better yet, to use your word awakening, to learn from the process, to realize that this isn't just Trump, but the United States had some problems before Mr. Trump came around. And as we protest the everyday iniquities and violations of the law, we can also learn what some of these basic problems were, for example, problems of race. So on the one hand, yes, we have an authoritarian president who's trying to create an authoritarian regime, but no, this isn't a prior typical
learn. Professor Snyder, your line is growing a little bit unstable, so I'm going to keep my fingers crossed because we just got 5 minutes left in the show and I don't want to stop hearing all you have to teach us. So let me just ask you something. I will fully admit that perhaps it's this job or this moment in history. I don't know what it is, but I might have a bias towards the negative examples of history, of how the slide does feel inevitable towards authoritarianism. Is there, in fact, a counterexample to that of times we've seen in the past before where it is not inevitable, where in fact democracies or liberties were restored when it seemed as if an authoritarian government was on the rise?
I think that's a wonderful question, because it goes right to the spirit of what democracy is. I think one of the mistakes Americans have made is to treat both democracy and authoritarianism as inevitable. So other people have authoritarianism because there's some, we have democracy because there's something right with us. Whereas in fact, democracies collapse all the time. They rise and fall. That's their history from the Greeks up to the present. There's nothing strange with what's happening to us now. If we realize that there's nothing strange about it, that this is normal, that this is kind of textbook authoritarian behavior, then as you say, we can look at other examples. We can say, let's look at the labor movement solidarity in communist Poland. Let's look at labor movements in general as sources of civil society. Let's look at the new country. Eastern Europe after the First World War, after 1989, and see how far right or far left movements could be defeated. Let's look at large scale peaceful protest movements around the world in the 20th century. We have a lot to learn from them. Every democracy that exists is an example of stopping an authoritarian transition. Democracies don't automatically exist. If one is there, that means people at some point have done the right thing and shown courage and intelligence. So the fact that there are democracies is very heartening. People have learned.
So the emphasis there, though, is on the people. The people vote for their representatives in government in the United States. We have a Congress full of people who ostensibly are supposed to represent their constituents. What is their role here?
Well, I mean, as I think we both suggested already in this conversation, there are things that are fundamentally wrong with American democracy before we get to Mr. Trump. So it's a problem that we have gerrymandering. It's a problem that there's too much money in politics. It's a problem that very wealthy people are able to affect the entire system. We would have better representation if we could clear out those problems. But of course, the Congress and the Senate that we have should be taking the position that defending the United States is about defending the citizens they represent, as opposed to defending abstract ideas of security or monuments. But I do think we're at a point. I mean, I think your intuition is important that, you know, that this is a point where things matter. It does matter what people do, that journalists write the truth, that people choose to protest, that law professors who know what they're talking about say things clearly. In history, where that's what's decisive. You can never really count on the institutions. You always have to fill up the institutions with life. And at some point, sometimes you have to tell the institutions what's what. And this, I think, is one of those times.
We've got about a minute left, Professor Snyder. I wonder if you see what's happening in Portland, what could soon be happening in other cities, because the president hasn't relaxed his desire to send federal officers to other American cities. Do you see this as a preamble or presaging the November election?
Oh, yeah. This is all just a tryout for November. Because the guys now that we see with the mismatched shoes and wearing the wrong kind of camouflage for urban operations, these guys are going to be the same guys who stand around the polling booths in November and intimidate the urban voters if we let this happen. But the way not to let this happen is to file the lawsuits, as folks in doing. It's to protest on such a scale, right, that this kind of intervention doesn't matter, which can be done. I mean, if you don't see a reason to protest so far, this is your reason to protest, because if this kind of thing is allowed to happen, everybody's rights are at stake. And of course, we have to vote, and we have to vote massively. So I think the president will continue to try. And I think this is indeed all about November, but that doesn't mean he has to win. And I don't think he will.
Well, Tim Snyder is the Richard C. Levin Professor of History at Yale University. He's a permanent fellow at the Institute for Human Sciences in Vienna, author of many books, including The Road to Unfreedom, Russia, Europe, and America, and On Tyranny, 20 Lessons from the 20th Century. We have a link to On Tyranny, an excerpt of it, actually, at onpointradio.org. Professor Snyder, thank you so very much.
It's been my pleasure. Thank you.
I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point.